I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Kainagata joins me now. We're going to talk about politics and the press. The provincial election results of the last day or so seem like a good place to start, and then we'll likely discuss what the polls were reporting, and then the reporting done by the media, both in the traditional forms and the social media that's ubiquitous nowadays. Kainagata is a freelance writer and videographer. He also commits satire at Deep Program. They've made some
guilty as charged.
They've made some hilarious videos there in July 2011. Rather than report the news, he made it with his very public resignation as the Quebec City Bureau Chief for CTV News. He had worked at the CBC and prior to that and was leaving daily journalism with a much-read 3,000-word essay on his blog at kainagata.com explaining his reasons. He proclaimed his faith in journalism to do good, but lamented that it wasn't being practiced in the newsrooms across this country. Tomorrow, Thursday the 16th of May, he'll be hosting Remix This, a copyright cabaret hosted by Fresh Media. That's at the Wise Hall on Adirondack. And the 1st and 2nd of June, he and Dan Murphy will be hosting a video production masterclass at the Taï. Visit the Taï's website for information on how to register. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Kai Nagata. Mr. Nagata, good morning.
Thanks for having me in, and I'm really sorry for being late.
No, you wanted me to ask you why you were late, I guess?
Well, I think I have a rather excellent excuse here. I've got this on my phone here. We were just driving through East Van on the way over here and spotted this coyote. But as you can see, he's only running with three legs, and he's got fur falling out of his sides. He looked totally mangy and possibly a little bit rabid, so we called the cops and animal control and stayed with the animal and followed him around until the cops could get there. But it was like a merry 20-minute chase he led us on, and of course there's all these little schoolgirls wandering out of backyards and people gardening and dogs and cats, and this thing is loping around the neighborhood.
So I'm watching the video off of your phone here, and how do you get it to stop? I mean, I don't know much about coyotes and the sort, but how do you, I mean...
Well, I'm not a wildlife control officer. If I'd had my bow and arrow in the car, maybe it would have been a different story, but...
Because you're driving very slowly, and then you're stopping, and it sort of looks at you, it stops, but then it goes along as well, right?
Well, I guess it speaks more to my natural talent as a videographer. I think it's just the coyote respected the camera.
Once you get in the shot.
A little bit of a camera hog. But, yeah, it's one of the more interesting videos I've ever shot on this phone, that's for sure. I don't think I'll put it up because I am clearly also operating a motor vehicle at the same time, so I don't want that on YouTube.
What was the leg, the missing leg, was that freshly taken off?
I don't know. It seems it had the fourth leg, but it was hopping, you know, even when
it
was running
away. Oh, I see. It had four legs. Okay.
It was just sort of dragging the fourth one. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, what part of town was this in? Was it around here?
It was over by Templeton High School.
Okay.
Actually, it was the other side of Nanaimo, so...
I see.
Sort of Hastings and Nanaimo area.
You went to Templeton, if I recall the research.
I did, and the cop who showed up is the current liaison officer at the school. So we said hello very quickly, and then she drove off to chase this coyote.
I guess we should start with the election.
Yeah, sorry, I'm tired.
No,
sidetracked.
No, that's fine. It's fascinating. It scares me now to think that there are coyotes in the city, you know? But I guess that's our fault.
Well,
it's
I feel bad for the coyotes, yeah. I mean, he didn't stand much of a chance.
Yeah. So what the hell happened last night?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody else. I mostly sat this one out. As a pundit, there were a few little satirical pieces that we released. Dan and Heather and I and my colleagues with Deep Program, our satire collective, we went after Christy Clark on a couple of things, but more just for fun. I stayed out of the actual reporting, and the one time I sort of jumped in after the first debate, I called the debate for Christy Clark and said that she'd won, but I still called a Dick's majority because I had no independent data. You know, I just went along with what the polls were saying, same as everybody else. And without having any other way to gather reliable information, aside from anecdotally, I mean, I had no better information, aside from a few whispers early on of some worries within the NDP camp about those inflated polling numbers at the beginning. But nobody, myself included, predicted that, and I don't think anybody can claim take any credit today for looking back and seeing that coming. So we have to ask ourselves some questions, and I think that there will be some interpretations that that win out over others in the coming days, and different theories will be competing, you know, to try to explain this rather uncomfortable episode in journalism and the taking of public polls. I mean, the polling industry is really sort of looking in the mirror today, and I wouldn't want to be in their shoes after what happened in Alberta and then watching this happen again in BC. Their entire profession is really, the credibility is at risk.
And do you think journalism takes some blame because they rely on polls so much? I mean, it sort of frames the stories.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing, right? And I harp on about how newsrooms are being hollowed out, but it's true. I mean, you look at how many staff used to be, how many members there used to be in the press clubs in the big city, just how many boots there were on the ground gathering information. That doesn't mean that you can, you know, out-poll a pollster, but it means that you at least have people picking up those interesting anecdotes along the campaign trail. These days, you've got people who are a couple of years out of journalism school who might have time to hit one campaign event during the day if they're lucky, but the number of reporters in the field has just gone down so drastically compared to the number of people reading, and that's because of economic constraints within the industry. Yeah, so you just don't have very good information. What you get is one company that owns a bunch of different outlets repeating the same information across all these different platforms, and then you have a few very coveted sources of information because it's very expensive to gather good data, and what you'll get is one news outlet that commissions a poll, and then everybody else runs the same numbers because they need the headline too, and that poll becomes news. So it's a sort of it's a vicious cycle.
And some of the tweets that we saw from, say, reporters on the campaign trail, whether they were following Dix or Clark, there was no insight, there was no context. It was just sort of repeating whatever the candidate had said at that moment.
Well, I can say from experience as a young reporter, right, who found myself covering politics in my second language in a province that I wasn't familiar with, culturally, you know, as much as I would have been if I'd grown up there, the fact is you're just sort of treading water out there some days. You're just trying to basically get the facts right and quote people correctly. But the people who are in the field, the institutional experience right now in these newsrooms is so thin that you don't have the capacity to offer a lot of analysis or insight or commentary. The best political reporters in those outlets are based in Victoria at the legislature. And then there's a few sort of old dogs who, you know, weigh in once in a while with a column. But the people who are out there in the field actually gathering the information and following the people on the campaign trail are generally very, very young, inexperienced, have only maybe seen a couple of elections, and probably this, for many of them, was the first time they were reporting on one. So through that context, it can be hard to filter out what's important and what isn't.
What do you make of, say, the gap between what the chattering classes have said on Twitter, social media, and in the traditional media, if you will, as opposed to the election result last night? I mean, are they isolated? Do they not get the general public, do you think?
Well, I think we saw something very clear, which is that there's sort of there's a way in which your brain is wired, if you follow politics really closely, that I think causes you to believe that other people think the way you do. And that is a kind of rational, analytical you know, filter that you apply to events in order to come to a decision. The reality, I think, was proven last night that most people don't think that way. Mm-hmm. Most people are not as well informed as the folks who are covering this. Most people are not as well informed as the pollsters. And so I think that the great flaw, if I can name it this early afterwards, of the Dix campaign was that they expected people to think coldly and rationally about the Liberals' record over the last 12 years, and through that lens, they couldn't see any alternative but to vote NDP. The fact is, though, that people aren't necessarily cold, rational, analytical creatures, right? We love stories. And so this is my main takeaway so far, and it's been less than 24 hours, but the NDP campaign didn't tell a story. It didn't tell a single story. The Clark campaign told several stories, good stories, powerful stories that connected with people, and I would say that those split into three different levels. So here they are. At the micro level, the one thing I did hear back from reporters who were covering the Clark campaign was that she always told stories about her family, about her son.
Yeah.
And we can say, She's just cynically trying to humanize herself to people. But you contrast that with Dix, and there are no photos of Dix grinning with children or hanging out with groups of people, right? He's the lone wolf. In those campaign stops, it looked like he was a guy who was sort of wandering from one scheduled event to the next, whereas Christy was busy telling people stories about herself and about her family. So at the micro level, I would say she was far more accessible, and she made a lot more use out of her campaigning and the time she was able to spend on the ground in all those different ridings. At the sort of macro level, she told a story about the economy and about confidence, about future, about your children that's connected to the personal story, right? Mm-hmm. So she was telling a story to British Columbians about stability, confidence. Her slogan about strong economy, secure tomorrow, speaks to people's concerns for their kids. And she was able to paint the inverse of that story, the shadow side of that story, very effectively, which was the NDP as this sort of tax and spend machine that, you know, would be a risky choice in a time of economic uncertainty. So those are the micro and macro stories. And then in the middle, what she did that was brilliant, I think, was to turn the campaign itself into a story in which she was the hero. Whether that was her design or her strategy people, they pulled it off stunningly, so that the campaign itself had an arc, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the story arc of the Dix campaign, it was basically just like a wedge, like a doorstopper, right? It just started from, like, we have a 20% lead, and then they just kind of gritted their teeth and held on and watched the lead just get sort of chipped away. But they didn't know what to do because they didn't know what the next chapter in the story was. Dix had that, Clark had that headline that we all made fun of, where she called herself the comeback kid. She bought the front page mm-hmm. of 24 Hours, and she plastered herself on there after the debate. And everyone said, oh, you know, that'll never work. But the point is, it doesn't matter that it was cynical and that rational people would look at that and say, well, she's just, trying to toot her own horn. The point is that she was telling a story about the campaign in which, at the last minute, the possibility of this underdog pulling off this huge upset became a reality that was manifested by the people that went out and voted for her instead of this unknown quantity that she'd painted in the form of Adrian Dix. So I think that from Hamish to the economy to the campaign itself, the polls, the tightening race, the underdog, she really turned this campaign into a story, and people like stories. They want to be part of stories. And if you give somebody a ballot and you say, well, do you want to be part of, like, I don't know, Adrian Dix's sort of army and mm-hmm. just march to the polls and do what you're expected to because the media and the pollsters say that that's what you're supposed to do? Or do you want to be part of this crazy story and make history? And clearly more people chose to go with Christy Clark's story.
What's the role of the journalist, or what should be the role of the journalist in all of this? Is it to report on the day-to-day activities? Is it to poke holes in, say, the platform or whatever the narrative is that the party or the candidate's trying to present?
Well, I think that there are always going to be several brands of reporting, and you have to hand it to the people who are just in the trenches every day, fact-checking everything that comes out of the leaders' mouths, because that is important. But to do that, you need institutional memory, you need resources, you need backup, you need people at the office who can feed you things as you're standing in a scrum. You know, you need human capital, and you need experience and a little bit of analytical distance that comes with experience. And that's just missing, I would say, in the press corps. So, yes, of course, their job is to report primarily, if you're thinking of it as like a pyramid, Maslow's hierarchy of journalistic tasks or needs, at the bottom, yeah, you have to get the facts right, you have to get what people say, and you have to publish that. But you also, like you say, need to be able to push back when it's clearly untrue. You need to be able to give people context when somebody's spinning or somebody's lying or somebody's, you know, engaging in revisionist history. Of course, that's the role of the press galleries, to say, but, well, remember this, and what about that, and this rings hollow because of this. But at a higher level, you need people who can read stories, I guess. You need people who can sort of pull together the narrative threads of a bunch of seemingly random events and make some sort of coherence out of that. And right now, I would say the state of politics right now is that the people who are really good at that are working on the campaign side, and they're beating the journalists and they're beating the pollsters. I mean, fact is, Nick Kouvalis and his team working for Christy Clark, they pulled off a pretty ballsy but well-disciplined campaign that relied on them just believing internally in their own numbers and their own strategy enough to get their machine in gear And they needed to believe that they were outsmarting the pollsters, that they had information that nobody else had, and they pulled it off, so you got to hand it to them.
2 years after this, I've got it in front of me here, printed off, blog post, this essay, these 3,000 words that announced that you were leaving.
Everyone always mentions the 3,000 words. I should have been more brief.
You know, I made a joke, I think, on Twitter at the time, not knowing you, of course. You know, one worried if you'd committed suicide, how long that note would be, you know. After all of this.
Well, you review books for a living, so, you know, if I ever start to feel some existential despair, I'll find a publisher and I'll get it to you first.
Have you gotten an offer to write a book?
Sure. I don't think I have enough to write a book about. I certainly don't feel like telling the CTV story again, so
yeah.
I got to spend a few years doing these
experiments. Because usually when something happens like this on the internet or in the press, something like that happens. Eventually a book deal comes out or something like that. But
yeah, there was some talk early on, but I'd rather spend my time trying new things out than writing.
And so 2 years after all of this, has the state of journalism improved, do you think?
Sadly, I can't say that it has. I mean, the trends that we were seeing when I was in the newsroom towards basically consolidation, vertical integration, the phenomenon I described earlier of big companies owning a lot of different outlets and repeating content across those outlets and then hollowing out the newsrooms and getting rid of the bodies that are required to gather that content, that trend is alive and well. You look at the financial situation of the Vancouver Sun and Province right now, the state of Sun News, as they try to launch a new all-Canadian quote-unquote news network, I give them points for chutzpah, but they unfortunately were not able to find an audience and are now in the position of having to go hat in hand to the CRTC. You know, I have my public disagreements with Sun News personalities, but at least they are trying to generate original Canadian news and commentary, and it looks like the market just can't support that, at least in the form that they've chosen. So, yeah, it's a really, really tough time, and I don't think it's gotten any easier since I left.
Yeah, to just mention Sun News for a sec, I heard from Tom Hawthorne from the Globe and Mail on this week when he was on. They do a 1 hour a night program during the election campaign just on BC politics, and none of the other networks did that, and I think they deserve, David Akin, I guess, deserves credit for that. After these 3,000 words, were you prepared for the sort of onslaught that you got from critics? I mean, some of them were mean. They questioned your sanity at some point.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. How could you be prepared for that? I mean, I wasn't prepared for any of it, and 90% of it was positive, and 10% was like profoundly negative and personal, and I think that I learned a lot of lessons about sort of sifting through what's important and what isn't. And most of the time, I think I learned more about the people that went after me than they knew about me. That was clear from some of the comments and columns and articles and attack pieces. And yeah, there's a couple of newspaper chains that just really, I don't know, got under their skin. So I felt like I learned a lot more about the individual writers who took umbrage at my personal decision. I think I was able to walk away from it a little wiser. I can't say that I saw that coming.
I mean, it must have been cool to have Roger Ebert talk about it. What was it? Did you think of that? I was just, yeah, I read that in something that he'd mentioned.
Yeah, rest in peace, Roger. That's true. I guess, it doesn't, looking back at it, it doesn't really feel like my life. It feels like, for a little while there, a few weeks, it was just like watching a movie about this happening. But what's funny about our culture, I guess, is that I did notice that it felt like I knew what to do. It was like you've seen this story play out enough times that you kind of have a script for it. And so I listened back to some of my answers then, and I look at some of what I wrote, and I think, like, in a funny way, in some senses, I was just sort of living out this movie script about somebody getting famous for no good reason.
Are there any regrets?
Well, I would say that there are personal relationships that I won't get back. There's things, you know, there's bridges that have been burned there that, you know, have been supplanted, I guess, by some pretty amazing opportunities, and some doors have opened and some relationships have formed and some opportunities have come up that, you know, I never could have imagined. And it's a really exciting time for me right now, but it's not ever easy, I guess, to lose friends and to know that your actions and your words have upset people who you respect.
But you'd never want to go back to that business?
Well, I can't say right now that it would be a particularly rational choice. I mean, I left the medium for reasons that I don't see changed.
Yeah.
If the whole industry structure were to change, and if the economics of news were to somehow make for the kind of good and rewarding and effective journalism that I always wanted to get into, and the kind of journalism that I admired. I think it's an incredible career, and there's a reason why I went into it, and there's a reason why I maintain friendship and have a lot of respect for the people who do it day in and day out. But I can't see myself doing that for a living, given the current state of the industry.
In terms of creating the sort of media that you want, I know that that's something that you wanted to do.
Sure.
2 years ago.
I mean
have you done
everybody?
That? Have you done that though with like things like Deprogram?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that I was like, I wasn't horribly repressed, or you know, it's not like I was in a gulag. I wasn't, you know, subject to top down editorial, you know, clamp down every day at CTV or CBC. But yeah, there's some things when you have like a day job that you just don't say at work, right? And
yeah.
There's things that you don't say on TV. I think that the larger problem is that the parameters of the debate right now in Canada, the political conversation is so limited in terms of options. Look at any piece of policy, and the sort of number of acceptable options for dealing with any sort of social problem is so narrow that the conversation, I think, is just necessarily stifled. I think we're just locked into this kind of cycle that generates certainly boring journalism and frustrating policy and the kind of cynical politics that we've seen play out over the last few years in this country. So I think, put it this way, I wasn't fixing the problem in journalism. What I was doing day in and day out was more of the sort of simple kind of journalism that I described earlier. I didn't have the talent or the contacts or the experience to be really making much of a difference with my position or my voice. And so I would say that journalism hasn't worked. It hasn't worked to keep the system honest. It hasn't functioned the way it is supposed to function, to hold decision makers to account and to keep citizens informed. When you have voter turnout dropping in every single election, when you have people who can, you know, prorogue parliament multiple times or spend all this taxpayer money on partisan advertising or pick your scandal. You know, if that doesn't register on the electorate and journalists have been sort of howling about it for years and it doesn't make a difference and people don't get out and vote, then I can't figure out a better metric to determine whether journalism is working. And I would say that journalism is failing in its basic goals as a sort of watchdog for democracy. So if journalism isn't working, then I think we have to look at other options. And sometimes I do feel effective as a columnist, as a writer, and sometimes I feel more effective behind the scenes.
Do you see yourself as an activist? Is the role of an activist taking that on now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think I have the same kind of disdain for the word that that some of my colleagues do. It's funny, the people who hate the word activist the most are either activists or, in some case, journalists.
Yeah.
But I think I'm a person who has very clear values, and then I have connected to those values, I have goals, and I think about every day when I get up, you know, given this goal or that goal, and my personal capacity and how I feel that day and what tools I have available and who I can work with, how do I think I can most effectively advance my values through my work? And so some days I think you just want to kind of throw in the towel and make a silly video, and I don't feel like there's a lot I can do to influence the outcome of a provincial election. from my vantage point. But there are times when, you know, I think it's important to kind of wade in and make some hard choices. And that's why I got involved with Joyce Murray's campaign at the federal level, because I'm not a federal liberal. I've never been a registered party member. But I saw Joyce trying to expand that conversation, trying to broaden the terms of the political conversation, and to get the liberals really thinking about sustainability, about future generations, about energy. And I thought, you know, she needs some help getting that message out there. And so when she asked, I thought long and hard, and I decided to jump in. So from the outside, I realized people might say, oh, well, that's an old story, you know, like ex-journalist becomes political, you know, comms guy.
Yeah.
And that's fine if that's your interpretation. I totally understand that. But what I'm trying to do is advance very specific policy goals connected to my values and figure out a way to make a living. So that's what's led me to the kind of work I do now, which is a bit of a hodgepodge, but which is oriented around some very clear goals.
Are you happy?
Yeah, this is a... You're catching me at a good time. I'm very fatigued because I just finished doing a video for a client overnight. But my work-life balance and the friendships that I've managed to cultivate and the connection that I've managed to rekindle with my family moving back here and the amount of time that I get to spend out on the land, both for work and just in my spare time, that stuff is really important to me. And I think that when you consider yourself an environmentalist or somebody who takes the environment seriously, you can't be locked up in a cubicle, you know, on Twitter all day.
Yeah.
And so the opportunity to just get outside, meet people, chase coyotes around East Van in my pickup truck. But seriously,
and film them at the same time. So I mean, you've got that part.
Got all the bases covered.
Yeah.
I look at that and I compare how I feel now and the horizons I see and the opportunities and options that I have. And I compare that to before when I supposedly had a position of power and influence and scope. And I feel far happier. And I think my health and my state of mind and my sleep patterns all reflect a getting closer, I guess, to the balance that I was looking for.
You mentioned earlier some friendships that you'd lost over the last couple of years. Were they people in the journalism business that you left behind? And were they reacting perhaps badly to what you were saying in this essay, that perhaps they were selling out?
Well, I think that implicit in any kind of criticism of an industry is the sort of question of, like, why would you spend your life doing that? And I tried to explain that, you know, I was really on a knife's edge. I could have gone back and done the job, and I'd probably be quite happy. You know, I would have found a way to do the job and find satisfaction in it, because I did. And you know, I had an amazing group of friends who did that for a living in Montreal and in Quebec City. And I think those that knew me understood, and the messages I got, especially from people in broadcasting who knew what had happened to the industry and who felt that grind and that sort of daily pressure, a lot of them got in touch to say, you know, if I didn't have a mortgage and I didn't have kids, I'd be right there with you. But a lot of people who never met me, never, you know, had no idea, had never seen me do my thing on TV, or who just, you know, made some assumptions, I guess, about me based on my age, mostly, were very, very bitter. And I think that there were some folks sort of in between who I crossed paths with, and who maybe just read the situation the way they wanted to, and decided later that that I was sort of criticizing them and their career choices. But no, I mean, I'm talking about the people who I lost. I mean, part of it's geography. I moved across the country. And part of it is just that, yeah, there's folks who do that day in and day out, and understandably can't reconcile that with one of their friends saying, this is not a good use of my time, and leaving.
Mm-hmm. Why did you go into journalism? Like, growing up, were there people you admired?
Yeah, I think...
I also read in the research that you grew up without a television, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I got a lot of flack for that. Because I've never owned a TV, and I didn't own one.
You don't own one now?
No. No, I mean, I had a TV in my office that I would watch, you know, the other channels on when I was in television. But, my TV training, I guess, came all through through videography, and I never enjoyed the act of sitting and watching television. So I understand if people feel that's unacceptable to be a TV reporter and not particularly relish the medium.
So how did you experience journalism then? Was it through print, through radio?
Yeah, I mean, largely radio, I would say, as a kid, having CBC radio on. But also print. I read a lot of international news, I guess, when I was sort of in high school and university, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be one of those guys who sort of parachutes into the disaster zone and, you know, finds the story in the rubble, and that was the kind of journalism, the reportage, that really excited me.
Were there specific people that you liked, though? You'll see that on my wall here, some of the folks that I like.
I don't know if you've read Michael Hare's compilation from the Vietnam War. It's called Dispatches.
I've seen that, yeah.
It was his writings for Esquire magazine, I guess. Most of them went unpublished. I think they had him in the field for months at a time, and they would take, you know, a piece every few weeks or every couple of issues, and the stuff he brought back is just unbelievable. I mean, it obviously left him terribly damaged, and there was probably a romantic aspect to the appeal as a young guy coming out of university.
Yeah.
The hard drinking, motorcycle riding, you know, camera slinging, damaged, PTSD-ridden war reporters that I saw and admired. And I don't know, I think, you know, I also simultaneously joined the Infantry Reserve when I came out of my undergrad. It was really sort of one or the other, and journalism one. But I was looking for adventure, and I was looking for validation through, you know, a proving ground, I guess. You know, and you have to work your way up to that. But that was always the thought, was that, you know, one day I'll be an international correspondent. And I guess I just sort of saw how the sausage was made, and I saw the steps you had to go through to get to that, and I saw how damaged the people were who do that for a living. And, you know, I met a lot of people and had a lot of mentors who'd been in the industry for a long time, and I realized that they weren't happy.
So what can we do? Is it like, I mean, I'm a consumer of media. I mean, that's how I see myself. I subscribe to newspapers. I watch television. I read stuff online and listen to the radio. There's a role that we play as consumers.
Sure.
And what is that role?
Well, I guess it's becoming more limited, right? We don't put classified ads in the newspaper anymore.
No.
So that's hurting them. We used to spend 20 minutes a day on average reading the paper over breakfast. Every man and woman in North America, that's clearly we're not holding up that end of the bargain anymore. So what do we do? I mean, what we do is we provide these demographic blocks that these outlets can then sell to their advertisers, right? And the more data they have on us, the more fine-grained their information, apparently, the more money they can get for targeting ads towards us. Newspapers and TV, unfortunately, are kind of blunt instruments, right? They're not very good at getting a message to a targeted group of people. They're good at getting a message to a lot of people, but the impact over time is debatable. So those values have dropped, and so our value as consumers to the industry has dropped, and I think that what we're getting back, the quality of the content we get in return, is reflective of that diminished value. Do we have a role to play in keeping those outlets honest? Yeah, I still believe, and I know from experience, that a well-placed call to the editor or to the newsroom can really help force journalists to look at things outside of more than just a binary black and white frame, you know? The default is to go to, like, he said, she said, yes, no, black, white, up, down. But I think when you are forced to talk to real people, and when people call up and say, you're missing this entire side of the story, that still has an effect, because, you know, most of the time they're just trying to keep their head above water. They're just trying to make the next issue or the next newscast. And so you are doing people a favor when you give them information, and when you talk to reporters and have a good relationship with them and you say, hey, have you thought about things this way? They appreciate that. I always appreciated it. You can take an active role. You don't have to just be, you know, a set of eyeballs that gets sold to advertisers. But just like there's not many of us who vote anymore, apparently, there aren't that many people who, I would say, have the critical reading skills, I guess, the vocabulary, to be able to parse what they are reading and what they're seeing. I guess it's a sort of a media literacy problem, and that's a failure of education, that's a failure of culture. It's not something that we can turn around in 5 years or 10 years. You just have people who don't see news media as a forum for engagement, and ultimately that's, you know, something that the industry has to look at and see where their model went wrong.
Kai, I appreciate you coming in to do this. I've long admired your zeal and thoughtfulness over journalism, and the videos that you do program are quite funny, so I appreciate you coming in. Thanks for this.
Yeah, sorry I'm such a bummer. You get me talking about the state of the news media, and I mean, I don't know what... There are great examples to point to. There's people doing a lot of really interesting things, and if I can just plug the TAI,
absolutely,
you know, they're providing a very... I would say high value service as a local news magazine, and I really enjoy collaborating with those guys and writing for the TAI. And I did want to mention that my colleague and friend Dan Murphy, who used to be at the Province, speaking of budget cutbacks, speaking of hollowing out newsrooms, Dan was the cartoonist who rather infamously last summer rejigged, I guess, one of the Enbridge advertisements.
The videos, yeah.
So he put some rude noises and some tar splotches over one of their ads, and ultimately got himself dismissed from the Province newsroom. Dan is a great storyteller and a great cartoonist, and he and I are going to be putting on a workshop the weekend of June 1st and 2nd at the TAI newsroom. Great opportunity to come in and pick up some skills around creating a video, and also some philosophy around distribution and doing it on the cheap. So for campaigners, journalists, marketers, bloggers, anyone who's branching out into video, I think you'd find it a valuable experience, and you'd be supporting the TAI. It's a fundraiser for more of the great journalism that they do in that newsroom.
People can get information of that on their website, thetai.ca, right?
That's right, the TAI, not tai.ca, because that's a Rona home building center, I think, in Couch and Bay or something, but no, thetai.ca.
Thetai.ca, and then, of course, kindagata.com and deepprogram.com. Kindagata joined me in the studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.